UK Wine Show, show number 168. Ian Edwards from the UK Vintners Association on the new EU wine regulations. G'day, my name's Chris Scott and welcome to the UK Wine Show. It's the 7th of August 2009. Well, after last week where I laid out the next five or so shows that we're going to be doing, I've ignored this for this week. This week we're going to be covering the UK Vineyard Association and the new EU wine regulations that came into force on the 1st of August 2009. I know I promised to talk about Chablis, but since the regulation change sort of snuck up on me, I thought I'd better slip this show in, which is talking about the regulations from the UK perspective and also how these new regulations came into force and were voted through. So next week we will start to look at Burgundy, starting with Chablis. Which I did when I did my trip to Italy. I tell you what though, it was a long trip home back to England from central Italy. I stayed with the Outlaws, that's Jane's family, and we're on the Tuscan-Umbrian border. And wow, it's a long way down there. The drive down there was okay because I was doing it by myself and I visited a lot of the wine regions on the way down. But coming back with a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old in the car, I'm very pleased to be back at Old Blighty, even if the weather is a bit humid at the moment. Right, back to the show. This week in the spotlight, we're going to be looking at our poll result, which is all about where do people get their recommendations to buy wines, and our mystery region, which is a lot easier than last week's Grigetto grape variety, is one of Australia's best-known wine regions. Situated an hour northeast of Adelaide in South Australia, it's famous for its red wines. Traditionally, the grapes were grown on the valley floor, but increasingly now they're planted on the higher grounds and on the hillsides. Now, I'm going to give you a lot more information about this after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Italian police have closed their investigation into the alleged adulteration of Brunello di Montalcino by declassifying 1.3 million litres of Brunello from DOCG to the less strict IGT category. Also, 680,000 litres of Rosso di Montalcino and Chianti Classico were also moved down to IGT status. If you recall, in spring 2008, 6.5 million litres of Brunello and 700,000 litres of Rosso were confiscated on suspected use of grapes other than Sangiovese, which is the only grape allowed under appellation rules. The wines were subjected to lab tests conducted by a government agricultural office in Florence.
Well, hopefully that'll put a lid on this little scandal, but I'm certain with regions with lots of controls that are hard to police, it'll only be a short time before the next scandal surfaces, whether it be in Italy, Austria, France, wherever. What's the next litigious thing, Jane?
Well, wine writer Martin Isaac is suing Majestic Wine over the alleged misuse of a tasting note, which he claims was used against the wrong vintage and without permission. This is the third time Isaac has taken legal action. In 2005, he sued Concha y Toro, and he has also taken Direct Wines to court. Apparently, both cases resulted in out-of-court settlements running into six figures.
That is a huge amount. It just goes to show that tasting notes aren't public material, even if they are published in the public. Another person suing is Michael Broadbent. He's suing Random House for defamation because of a book, The Billionaire's Vinegar. Broadbent says Wallace accused him of inventing a bid for a half bottle of 1784 Margaux, which he sold while he was in charge of Christie's wine auctions. According to Broadbent, the veteran former director of Christie's, he's suing for libel in the UK because the book's available here, although it is published by Random House in the US. While I have no comment on the legality of the claim, one thing is for sure, by suing in the UK rather than the US where the book was published, it will result in a miscarriage of justice. The UK system of defamatory is appalling and incredibly expensive. Broadbent is almost certainly suing here because of the huge cost and the court processes normally makes most people back down or agree out of court settlement. So while he'll almost certainly settle out of court or maybe even appear to win, the truth will never come out. If he'd wanted the truth to come out, he should have sued in the US where, believe it or not, the system is more streamlined, quicker and cheaper. And if he wanted to do it cheaply, the continent, Europe, is the best place. For something a bit different, what's the last story, Jane?
Well, the famous dessert wine Sauterne is about to undergo a change of image in order to appeal to younger drinkers. Producer Chateau d'Arche is to launch its second wine, La Perle d'Arche, into nightclubs served in 100ml test tube-shaped bottles. Initial trials will be in Bordeaux and Singapore this September, and there are plans to roll out to Australia, the Far East, and potentially the UK and United States. The test tube bottles will be presented in ice buckets at the bar to tempt female drinkers. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to visit our website 3050.co.uk to check out these stories in full.
Cheers, Jane. I'll be interested to see what happens in the UK and Australia. Both countries take a dim view of drinks companies selling wine in test tubes, which might be seen as encouraging people to drink fast. And while Good Sauternes certainly will appeal to a younger generation, I don't know if a test tube is the right format. I think it's a step too far and probably the wrong shape glass at the wrong time. Oh well, that ends the news. Next up, we have the Spotlight. This week's Spotlight is looking at the results from our wine poll. The question was, which of the following is most useful when buying wines? Was it a recommendation from a friend, from a wine column, or maybe a wine and food magazine, or from websites, or finally from published wine books? For me, a good wine recommendation source is an essential guide for choosing wine. It helps avoid poor wines. Whether you give yourself over to someone famous with lots of knowledge, or your mate down the road who likes to experiment, it's ultimately about how similar your palate is to theirs. If they like big tannic monsters, and you prefer softer rounded wines, then you need to question the suitability of them recommending wines to you. Not that their palate's wrong, it's just inappropriate for you. The advantage of following media types, that's wine writers, bloggers, etc., is that they generally get to try a massive range of wines, and if their palate's similar to yours, then you can experiment with confidence. In our poll, most people said that the recommendation from a friend was the most important, with 65% preferring to rely on the friends. I suppose the advantage of that is you probably live near your mates, and you've probably got access to similar wines as well. 23% of people said they use wine columns in the weekend newspapers or food and wine magazines. It certainly puts a lot of power in those masked imbibers. Online websites came in a distant third with 8%, which isn't too bad. I presume this is more sites with blogs than, say, sites selling wine. The last was 4% of people who said they used published wine guides. I presume this is because the sales of these are quite small and are really geared towards a hardened enthusiast. Now, a large number of people who did our poll actually come into our polls through our wine tastings. We get people to fill out the form at 3050's wine tastings. These people are enthusiastic and enjoy wine, but most of them are near the beginning of their wine journey and are unlikely to have bought a wine book anyway. From my point of view, blogs are an excellent source of cost-effective information, particularly if you agree with the palate of the wine writer. The downside is that they may taste wines that you don't normally have access to. But ultimately, if you want a concise recommendation, you need to buy a book, in my opinion. But the right book is hard to find. You could buy a book that covers all the countries or a region in minute detail, and certainly I've got a few of those, but these are really for the hardened enthusiast. Probably more sensible is to buy a book that aligns with your shopping habits. For example, Malcolm Gluck used to do the Superplonk, the top supermarket wines. Or perhaps Max Skinner's wine recommendation books, where the wines are generally available on the high street. After all, there's no point buying a wine recommendation book if you're never going to find those wines where you shop. Ultimately, as I said at the beginning, one person's advice is as good as another's, as long as their palate matches yours. For truly unusual wines, though, you need a book or experts who taste thousands of wines a year, and this is where books come into their own. Speaking of books, next week we're going to be reviewing the book Wine for Dummies. Quite a surprising book. But next up, let's have the clue for our mystery region. Wine was first made in this Australian region in the 1840s, a decade after German peasants settled in the area. These early wines were fortified, and it wasn't until the 1950s that the likes of Peter Lehman and Max Schubert, who first made Penfolds Grange, started making table wines. The region ran into problems in the 1970s and 80s when the world didn't want their big, sturdy wines. But things have changed and new winemakers have been carved out a niche with their big Shiraz-based reds that leap out of the glass. These are packed with spice, tannins, rich fruit and classically have tar and leather and chocolate characters. The Mediterranean climate of cool winters and hot, dry summers combined with fertile brown soils made it possible to grow just about any grapes here. But it was Shiraz and the other Rhone varieties such as Grenache and Mourvedre that did best. Right, that should be enough for some of you to get this famous Australian wine region. For the rest, I'll give you the answer and the clues after our interview with Ian Edwards. As I said earlier, the new EU legislation has snuck up on me, and I recorded this interview after the final consultation document had been written, but before the final nod. So we talk about a couple of points, such as rosé, which hadn't quite been sorted out a couple of months ago when I did the interview. Let's have a listen to what Ian has to say. Hi, I'm here with Ian Edwards from the UK Vintners Association and winemaker yourself from England, Firley Estates. How are you, Ian?
I'm fine.
What's your role at the UK Vintners Association?
I'm on the council. I'm chairman of the Wessex region, and I'm treasurer to the UKVA. I've also been on the subcommittee, which has been working with DEFRA on the new EU wine reforms.
Excellent. We're going to be talking about that in a minute. But do you want to just briefly tell me what the UK Vintners Association is?
It's a trade body for people in the industry. And it deals with basically all aspects of the industry, apart from marketing, which is run by the English wine producers, which is a separate organization. But it works very closely with the English wine producers.
Okay, so you're more of the trade body, so you're more a producer face?
Yes, we deal with legislation, education, sort of helping new people come into the industry.
And how long's UKVA been going for?
Oh, I don't know, 10 or 15 years.
10 or 15 years? Yeah. So a reasonable length of time. Yeah. I must admit, I thought you'd been going for ages and ages.
It used to be called, had a different name previously. There was a previous organisation which took on both the roles of EWP and the UKVA, but that disbanded about 10 or 15 years ago and it split into two
parts.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. So how many people are in the UKVA? Is it a compulsory scheme or is it?
No, it's not compulsory. It's people who come into the industry can decide whether they wish to contribute, join, and enjoy the benefits or not. And probably most people who are growing vines in the UK are members of the UKVA, but not all.
Not all of them. Okay, and what sort of fees do you have to pay to them?
The basic fee is just under £50, and then there's a hectarage levy, so the bigger your fees, it's about £60 a hectare, up to 7 hectares. So the biggest vineyards pay close to £500. The small vineyards only pay about £50.
Okay, but for that you get sort of access or at least an opportunity to argue the UK's...
The UK VA Council, all the members work without pay. There's only one paid employee, one part-time employee in the whole of the UKVA. So they get, there's a trade magazine, there's a database, discussion database, they get information on spraying, and there's a regular bulletin that goes out fortnightly, keeping it up to date on what's happening.
Oh, I have to try and get on that list to get that. Do I have to be a member to get the news?
Or? In theory, yes.
So that'd be 50 quid a year because I don't have any hectarage.
Yeah, that's right. There are quite a few members who just pay the £50.
What we're going to talk about a wee bit is some of the new legislation that's coming into the UK, or at least it's been debated about how to implement in the UK. Let's take one step back, though. A lot of the legislation you're dealing with has been driven by Europe, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And how does the UKVA interface with the European Parliament?
Through DEFRA, which is a government organisation. European legislation set through Brussels, and the rules are set down at a European level, and then each member state has to then implement the rules through legislation in its own country.
Yeah.
And DEFRA has that responsibility for implementing that legislation and then also regulating it.
Okay, and the UKVA deals with DEFRA. It's sort of like a lobbyist representing the industry.
We work together essentially too.
Okay, I imagine there wouldn't be. Is there many other people who have a position that try and work with DEFRA on this? Because lobbyists there's normally two or three different points of view trying to drive it, or is it?
It will be
nice?
Certainly on some aspects there are. Obviously, in the UK, the UKVA only produces a very small percentage of the alcohol drunk in the UK, very tiny. And so there are other bodies who interested in the retail aspect of selling alcohol,
who are also
lobbying or involved, but on sort of slightly different aspects of the legislation from where we are.
Okay, I suppose they're not really worried about yields, etc.
That's right. When it gets down to the nitty gritty of the winemaking, then it tends to be just the UKVA. The others aren't that interesting.
It's quite good then, isn't it? It's easy for you to come up with an agreement.
Yeah.
Europe's got a lot of new proposals, or the new person in charge of viticulture for European Ministry. They've had some quite ranging ideas that came out about a year ago in terms of cutting back yields quite significantly and giving subsidies, and also planting bans as well.
and those have worked their way through the system. They haven't been voted on at the European level, or have they?
Yeah, they have. They became law last April. April last year. Yeah, the way European legislation works, the Commission, you get the Council regulations, which are sort of high level, mm-hmm. And the characters you see on the or hear about and read about in the papers and they see on the press, they get involved at that level. And there's a piece of legislation was put in place last year, which gives the framework for the new laws, the new regime. But it describes the framework at a fairly high level. And that was what talked about planting bans. It talked about cutting back on funding and supplements, grants. And it talked about restricting chaptalization and sweetening wines.
Yeah.
So that overall framework was set. Once that's been set, the sort of the public figures sort of tend to drop away, and the implementing legislation is done by the Commission, who are civil servants essentially.
Yep. Yep.
And we have been talking to Luke, who's been the senior civil servant, who's been responsible for getting the implementing legislation in place.
Okay, and so the legislation's been agreed and voted on.
It has been agreed. It has not been voted on. The way the process works, there's a lot of lobbying goes on. Various drafts are produced. There are numerous meetings occurring every few weeks, where the different member states put their points of view and try and get amendments to the drafts. There's then a final series of meetings where for each country to try and get a small change introduced. And once that point is agreed, the legislation is then translated into all the different languages and printed and sent out for voting. Mm-hmm. But as part of that final process, I think it's also agreed what type of vote, the form of the vote on the day it will take. My understanding is that for this legislation, the intention is that there will not be a vote. It will go through on the nod.
So what does that mean, the nod?
They seem to have agreed that it will not go to the vote, that it will just pass through.
So you can pass legislation in Europe without voting on it?
If you agree in advance that that's what you're going to do. So if there's no strong opposition to the legislation.
Okay.
You don't actually physically vote. It just goes through.
So once that legislation has been nodded, quite a nice bit of democracy in Europe, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
What are the key parts of the legislation? Because I saw a lot of early stuff and I haven't seen the more recent.
Yeah. Well, the early stuff was probably seen about was things about planting bans and varietal restrictions and that sort of thing. We did very well. The UK did very well out of that. I think partly because we're so small, they basically gave us everything that we asked for. So we're not subject to a planting ban and never will be. We are allowed to, we have no restrictions on the varieties we can plant here. We can plant anything we like. And that will be the case until we become quite a lot bigger.
Because we were getting close to it in terms of volume of production.
The old limit we were.
What are the old limits and what are the new limits?
There is a new limit, but it doesn't apply to the UK.
Well, you've done quite well.
That's right. The way the legislation is drafted, a planting ban will not apply to the UK. Full stop.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
Okay, that's quite nice, isn't it? Okay, what other parts are there? So the planting ban, there was talk about chaptalization, big thing, adding sugar to the UK wine, especially after the last couple of vintages.
Yeah.
I'd hate to see what the wines would be like without the chaptalization. The idea there was to stop people adding sugar, so producing less wine, really, wasn't it? By adding sugar, you can have higher yields and therefore you can produce more wine and you just add a bit of sugar to get the alcohol up. But by removing chaptalization, the idea is maybe just put a squeeze on some of the production.
That's right. And there has been, for the UK, there's been a small reduction in the amount of chaptalization we're allowed to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not really material because there's a secondary, there are two limits. There's one about the maximum amount of sugar you can add, and that has been reduced. But there's another restriction, which applies to most wines, which once you actually chaptalize, there is an absolute limit on the alcohol level you can produce.
Mm-hmm.
And that has stayed the same.
So what you're saying is there's like you can only add 100 grams of sugar to a bottle of wine, but you must keep it below 11%.
That's right. So as the grapes ripen more, the amount of sugar you can add is reduced.
Yeah.
Because you can't go for this
alcohol level. Yeah. And what are those limits?
For white wines, it's 11.5%, and for red and rosé, it's 12%.
Okay. And what's the sugar limit? Do you know what amount of sugar you're allowed to add is?
The equivalent of 3% of alcohol.
Oh, okay. All right. So, yeah, it's measured in alcohol, is it? So if you've got grapes coming in at below 8.5%.
Yeah, you could add 3% and make it a little.
All right,
yeah.
And above 8.5%, yeah. Only up to 11%.
Right. That's right. So although there was the reduction of 0.5%, it's not really significant to us because very few people putting in the maximum.
So chaptalization, not really a big one for us. Planting ban, not really a big one for us here as well, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
What other things were coming through? Rosé?
That's come through later. On this second, we were very, very pleased with the first, the overriding legislation. We basically had a shopping list and we got just about everything on our list. The only thing we had to concede on was the chaptalization. And we got everything else. On the implementation legislation, which is the one that's actually going through now, going through the commission, everything looked fine from our perspective until around Christmas when there was some new paragraphs introduced into the draft. Which affected this is largely about labelling, mm-hmm. Which affected the way you could describe your wines, and in particular how you used locations, geographical units to market your wines,
mm-hmm.
And that had potentially quite a big impact on us in the UK.
How's that?
Essentially because in the UK, we're a very small industry, very tiny industry,
yep.
And we tend to play on selling to tourists and the like. So it's quite a common practice to name your wines with some association to a tourist site or a tourist label.
Stonehenge, Glugger.
Yeah. that's right. And this new, the whole basis of the new legislation, or one of the fundamental principles of the new legislation that's come in, is that the quality of wine is determined by the location of the grapes. It's essentially the French system being
terroir,
terroir system being imposed across everybody. When the legislation was first introduced, it was supposed to be opening up the market and making it fair for everyone. And we interpreted that as being, you know, you could create brands. But in fact, the way it's actually gone is the other way. The terroir rules are actually coming to force, and they're being imposed across everybody. And people outside Europe also are being quite heavily affected.
How does that affect? Like, I know Europe's been driving things like geographical indicators into other countries like Australia. You know, they're doing a massive job there in terms of sorting out their GIs.
Yeah.
As far as I'm aware, the UK doesn't really have any geographical indicators.
No, that's right. That's a problem. That's a problem for us.
And you talk to winemakers and they say, look, we just don't know what they are. It's too early.
Yeah, that's right. That's the problem. It's all right for France and Italy. They've made wine for many, many years and they've established these areas and they have all the infrastructure in place to support them. But here in the UK, that's not the case. It's very early days. Our vineyards are scattered over quite large areas. We don't really know the characters of the different regions. And it's actually quite difficult for us to fall into their system.
So what will that mean? Will you have to create some GIs? Or?
We effectively do have some, for still wines, we do have some GIs, because we have a quality scheme.
Yep.
And they are effectively the counties. Well, each individual county is a GI, is the way it's
been defined. Well, it's been done, so there's an Essex GI.
And the country, so England and Wales are also areas, which are already recognised in statute. And so we're basically having to latch on to those areas to fit in with the new system.
Yeah, because that's not really sensible, is it, by splitting it up by county, because you've got different soils and climates that don't really follow county boundaries. You know, county boundaries are more governed by fiefdoms, wasn't it?
That's right.
500,000 years ago.
That's right.
So we're going to land up with wines that are disconnected from the climate and the region they're grown, because to fit into that sort of...
That's right, but it's just too early for us to actually start defining those areas.
Is there an opportunity later on?
There is an opportunity later on to do that, although the process for actually defining one of these areas will become much more complicated after the 1st of August. There is an opportunity at the moment to do something before the 1st of August.
And what's going on there?
And, well, the big problem for us in the UK was actually on the sparkling wines, because... in the sparkling wines, although we've been hugely successful, don't have a quality scheme as defined by the legislation, which has to be in statute.
Mm-hmm.
So there are no regions. For sparkling wine, there are no regions. We have no regions defined. Under the new regime, all our sparkling wines would be treated as though they were like the table wine equivalent.
Yep.
Yeah, because there's no quality scheme in place. Even though quite clearly the quality of what's produced is much better than that.
Yeah, for sure.
So one of the things we're having to do between now and the 1st of August is introduce a quality scheme.
And what's that going to be based around?
It's still very much under discussion, but we will probably have to base it on counties again. because we just don't have anything else.
How will that affect
people like English wine producers who get grapes from all over the place? They don't just grow it in Essex. They grow
they grow it all over the place.
Well, the rules polarize businesses and the way you name your business and the way you name your wines. So if you want to name your business after a location, a geographical unit, then you essentially are restricted in getting your grapes from that unit, from that location.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you want to be able to expand and buying grapes from elsewhere in the UK, then you've got to name your business with some made up brand name that doesn't relate to the location. And it's basically a fundamental business decision about which path you go down right at the start. Because if you start with don't go down the first path, it may be quite difficult for you to switch to the second path.
Oh, really?
You actually change.
You can't have multiple brands. One brand.
Oh, you could have two. Obviously, you could do that. But if you started
by calling yourself Sussex Vineyard, Sussex White Horse Vineyard, or something like that, you'd be in trouble.
Then you'd be restricted to buying grapes from Sussex.
Yeah.
If you were hugely successful and wanted to expand, everyone knew your name. But you would have to only be able to get your grapes from Sussex. And if you wanted to start buying in from outside, you'd have to change your name.
Okay, I'm with you.
I don't see a lot of, like, I see the English quality standard, the what is it called?
For still wines, there's a standard. It's there's quality wine. There's quality wine PSR, I think is how it's phrased at the moment. It'll be shortened to quality wine going after the 1st of August.
But I don't see a lot of...
And there's regional wine, which is a level lower than that.
I don't see a lot of names, though, like Essex or Kent on any of the labels or any of the descriptors. Am I just missing something, or is it?
Under the current rules, there's two levels. There's the quality scheme, which is the top level, and there's the regional wine scheme, which is a middle level, and then there's table wine, which is the bottom. Yeah. If you're doing table wine, you're not allowed to put where it's come from, essentially. You can put where it's bottled, but you can't put where the grapes have come from. If there's a quality wine, you have to put quality wine PSR, and you actually can't allow to put any other location on. And it's only for the regional wines that you can put the counties on, so you will see people putting, we put Dorset regional wine, when you'll see Sussex regional wine, Kent regional wine, or sometimes people just put English regional wine. It's really only in that middle band that you can use the county name at the moment.
Oh, okay.
But that will change slightly because we'll still have the two tiers, but you'll be able to put the name of the location, whichever tier you're in.
What other, we talked about the rosé, we touched on that was quite topical at the moment.
The rosé, that was the biggest issue on the labelling side. On the winemaking side, there's a separate implementation legislation, and they're basically trying to open up the winemaking practices so that more practices are acceptable. And the other thing they've done is they've made the process for changing the rules easier.
Mm-hmm.
Before it had to go all the way up to the EU council to be able to change the rules. It's now being changed at commission level, which is slightly easier to do. But they're trying to follow essentially OIV practices. Anything that's an acceptable OIV practice will be accepted in Europe, is the intention.
What's OIV?
It is the international body.
All right. So what about things like spinning cone and some of the de-alkalized?
Yeah, that's the sort of thing they're introduced. They're going to start to allow.
They're going to allow that. Okay.
Those practices.
Because it's crazy at the moment. You're allowed to bring the wines in. You have to make them in the States to bring them in.
Yeah, that's right. And that's all being opened up. I'm trying to create a level playing field there. Yeah. And it's in that area that this rosé issue has arisen, because in other parts of the world, you can make rosé by blending red and white wines, which in Europe, currently that's banned.
Except for in champagne.
Yeah, that's right. Champagne, you can do it, but for still wines, you can't do it. But under the new rules, you can. The French have kicked up a fuss.
Saying that
they've made an amendment to the labelling regulation so it's clear. So you've got traditional rosé, which is made the normal French way, or you've got blended rosé, which is a blend of red and white wines.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how it stands at the moment. And although the French are still making a noise, I don't know how successful they're going to be. I think my understanding of what the position is now, it's going to be quite difficult for them to make a change now.
Okay. All right. I think we'll leave it there, Ian. Thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Cheers, mate.
As I said earlier, the new EU regulations came into force on the 1st of August 2009, and they passed pretty quietly into being without too much coverage from the media. But from the August the 1st, all wine labels are now allowed to mention grape varieties and vintage on the label. Simplifying labels is part of the strategy adopted in the new regulations, although it doesn't always sound sensible. The French AOC system, Appellation d'Origine Contrôle, becomes AOP, Appellation d'Origine Protégée. And the equivalent of Interpays now becomes IGP, Indication Geographique Protégé. A voluntary three-year grubbing-up scheme to encourage uncompetitive producers to leave the industry will be put into place as well. Marion Fisher-Boll, the European Commission for Agriculture and Rural Development, and the lady driving the reform, and also the lady that looks a bit like Margaret from The Apprentice, said member states and producers have great opportunity to make the best of the new wine regime to build on Europeans' international reputation for excellence. I truly believe this marks a turning point in our wine sector's history. Possibly, we'll see. What I like is that the money used to fund distillation subsidies will be redirected into wine promotions and modernization of vineyards and cellars. Not too happy about government money given to poor performing wineries, but the end to emergency distillation is a huge step forward. If no one wants the rubbish wine that they're producing, why should my taxes have to pay for it? That's all I'm going to say, and thank goodness that's over. The other significant improvements include the ending of restricted planting bans in most European countries by 2016 and all of Europe by 2018, as well as restrictions on chaptalisation, although as we said in the interview, that doesn't really affect the UK too much. Okay, that almost ends this week's show. Next week we're going to be looking at Burgundy, I promise, and it'll be looking at Chablis, honest. But to close out this week, we have the Mystery Region, which is a famous Shiraz-producing region from Adelaide. It was, of course, Barossa. Here are the clues again. The Barossa Valley is Australia's best known region. Situated an hour northeast of Adelaide in South Australia, it's famous for its red wines. Traditionally, the grapes were grown on the valley floor, but increasingly now they're being planted on the higher ground of the hillside. Wine was first made in Barossa in the 1840s, a decade after German peasants settled in the area. These early wines were fortified, and it wasn't until the 1950s that the likes of Peter Lehman and Max Sherbert, who made the Penfolds Grange, started making table wine. The region ran into problems in the 1970s and 80s, when the world didn't want their big, sturdy reds. But things have changed, and new winemakers have been able to carve out a niche with their big Barossa reds that leap out of the glass. These are packed with spice and tannins and rich fruit, and classically have tar, leather and chocolate characters to them. The Mediterranean climate of cool winters and hot, dry summers combined with fertile brown soils to make it possible to grow almost any grapes. But Shiraz and the other Rhone varieties such as Grenache and Mourvèdre do best here. Officially, there is Barossa Zone, which comprises of both Barossa Valley and the hilly Eden Valley abutting it. And that's pretty much it for the Barossa Valley. To finish up with this week, we've got our quote, and it was from the movie Never Give a Sucker an Even Break, said by the actor W.C. Fields, "I was in love with a beautiful blonde once. She drove me to drink. That's the only thing I'm indebted to her for." Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.